Thank you. As already been said, I am acutely aware of the language barrier. So please, if I am speaking too quickly, don't suffer in silence. Please do let me know and I will be sympathetic. First of all, I took it as a testament to the famous German sense of humour that the reward for a man like me, who has spent most of his days and nights for the past 2 months organising and promoting a series of international events, was asked to fly in at the crack of dawn to Frankfurt this morning to talk about the obsession with living healthy lifestyles. This was actually supposed to be my quiet week, but my colleagues from Novo were not alone in distracting me from that. My week began with a phone call at 6:30 a.m. on Monday morning asking me to be on the radio in Northern Ireland, which had then finished with me being on the radio that evening before being on the TV news by Wednesday before finding myself out here. In today's world of increasing regulation of private life, I've come to the conclusion that Jean-Paul Sartre was wrong. Hell is not other people. Hell is spending your free time defending the rights of other people to have a good time. The reason I haven't been getting that much rest this week has been the activity of the British Medical Association, something akin to the doctors' trade union in the UK. On Monday, the UK Parliament was debating extending the smoking legislation to follow South Africa and some states in the US and Australia in banning smoking in cars carrying children. For the BMA, this proposal did not go far enough. They wanted the government to ban smoking in all cars, citing the evidence that smoking in cars exposed you to 23 times more toxins than sitting in the smokiest bar before smoking was banned in the UK in 2007. The risk of vulnerable children being exposed to the smoke of irresponsible adults at a crucial point in their development was too strong to give consideration to the so-called freedom of adults to do as they wished. For many people, this would appear to be a fairly common sense equation. Unfortunately, the essential absurdity of this statistic, the idea that smoking a single cigarette in a car would be more toxic than sitting all evening in a bar packed full of chain smokers, did not seem to occur to most public health advocates. But then it did not occur to them that these self-destructive nicotine addicts would have the good sense to even consider opening a window to let the smoke out. By Thursday, the BMA were forced to issue a retraction. The 23 times figure was exposed as a myth. Indeed, it had been exposed as a myth in 2010 by the Canadian Medical Authority Journal, which revealed it was an exaggerated misreading of one single study which bore little relationship to the reality of cigarette smoke. The researchers of that article pleaded with their fellow public health lobby to stop using this spurious and substantiated statistic, understandably feeling that it undermined trust in doctors and medical researchers. But they went on to argue that there were far many more arguments to use which hadn't already been discredited or deployed effectively elsewhere, from the road safety risks of lighting up a cigarette behind the wheel to the risks of children taking up the habit because they see their parents or other adults smoke. This was a small victory, but when you are engaged in trying to defend civil liberties and people's private lifestyles in the UK, you take your victories where you can. But this example was particularly revealing, because I think it is an interesting case study of the authoritarian instincts behind the regulation of personal behaviour and how it is able to take root. First of all, we have the willingness to deploy the evidence, no matter how spurious its accuracy or detached its basis from everyday lived experience. Yet while there is a growing trend in the UK around scepticism surrounding bad science, whether it's homeopathy, TV psychics, or climate change deniers, it is observed that the biggest offenders of the misuse of statistics often are public health lobbying groups, variously Alcohol Concern, Action on Smoking and Health, and our friends at the British Medical Association. But they are often given an easy time by the people who dedicate themselves to tracking down the abuse of science. After all, the argument goes, if it convinces people to drink or smoke less, or to take better care of their diet, what could be the harm? Perhaps understandably, health workers and professionals are able to justify themselves in telling the good lie. But from that, it is not too big a leap to turn undesirable and personally harmful behaviour into irresponsible or socially harmful ones. The extension of John Stuart Mill's harm principle is extraordinary in this regard, and it cuts both ways. The prevailing orthodoxy in healthcare today is harm reduction, a specific medical understanding of treatment of drug addicts and alcoholics as victims in need of treatment and understanding rather than moral judgments. This may appear to be an understandable and sympathetic reaction when dealing with the realities of serious drug addiction, but becomes quickly extended in the public discourse to applying to the moral autonomy of anyone who chooses to live an unhealthy lifestyle today. We are all only a matter of bad genes, bad upbringing, or simple bad luck from becoming drug abusers, alcoholics, wife beaters, binge eaters, and so on. We could not imagine that an adult addicted to nicotine could not be sensible enough to open a car window. By extension, with limited control over our own private lives, we cannot be trusted not to harm others. So alongside the exaggerated threat we pose to each other, through passive smoking, drink-fueled violence, and so on, we cannot rely on our own adult authority to influence others if they're engaging in socially undesirable behaviour. We cannot simply ask people not to blow smoke in our face, not to behave inappropriately in public spaces when drunk. We have to ask an external body to take that action for us. And the use of children in this regard is telling. As members of our society not recognised as possessing full autonomy and thus in need of certain protection, we are always encouraged to think of the children in these discussions. Yet when adult autonomy and authority is undermined, we are faced with a serious crisis of what we expect them to become socialised into. If, for those of you who followed the riots that we had in England over the summer, you could see how very quickly the reactions split into two categories of the what we dubbed on Spiked the hug'em or hang'em critique of whether these were poor youth who have been deprived and don't know how to behave, or whether they're people in need of the army on the streets and discipline. And in the UK, we are close to an increasingly Victorian depiction of the young today, either idealised angels in need of our constant vigilance and protection from dangerous adults, or feral youth in need of increasingly strict monitoring and policing. In between, of course, are their parents, who are increasingly made to feel that they are one bad choice away from, to paraphrase the English poet Philip Larkin, fucking them up. This is the breeding ground for what today is an increasing politicisation of behaviour and lifestyle. In being unable to trust ourselves and each other in regulating our public spaces as adults, we invite the state in to do it for us, whether it's in the form of smoking or drinking bans, antisocial behaviour orders to protect adults from miscreant youth. These are orders we have in the UK which will restrict the movement of children who have committed a crime of some kind but have not been charged with it, to try and gently, before we take them down the law courts route, so therefore also not making them accountable in quite the same way to a judiciary, to try and monitor their behaviour. On the other hand, we have to try and protect children from the potential sexual menace of adults and paedophiles. So we ask them to submit to a criminal records background check before that anyone is allowed to work with a child under the age of 16 in the UK, regardless of whether you're a football coach, whether you happen to want to offer your neighbour's kids a ride to school, or you have any sustained period of engagement. In allowing this poisonous atmosphere between the idea of what adults and children are, we are surrendering authority over our public, our private spaces, justifying any manner of state intrusions into affairs previously considered none of the state's business. Our cars, our homes, our family lives, our relationships with doctors, and so on. While this initially took an openly authoritarian nanny state form in the US and UK, we have seen the rise of a new strand, a very illiberal form of liberalism, taking on the invasive form of nudge or behaviour modification. This argument goes that we are not going to stop you from making bad choices, but we will seek to influence those choices whether you consent to them or not. So you may drink as much as you want, but we will introduce a minimum price for alcohol, what John Stuart Mill dubbed a sin tax, to penalise you for doing so and regulating where it is you are free to drink. You may of course smoke, but you cannot do so in public lest children are allowed to see you, and nor can you travel Work with children who are not your own, or even be trusted to respond to reasonable requests to modify your own behaviour accordingly. More and more as we accept greater state regulation of our public spaces, our conception of what constitutes a private sphere necessarily narrows. The further we retreat, the further the state is obliged to reach to ensure we are not harming ourselves or others. Nobody can be entirely happy with the idea of what goes on behind closed doors today. The first step in trying to work out our way out of this cycle is first and foremost, I think, to defend our autonomy, our freedom to make bad choices, to be prepared to judge others, but act on it as moral individuals, rather than outsourcing this authority to others. In other words, rather than trying to take on the language of liberalism, which we see in a lot of these contemporary forms, I think we have to try and re-establish what it is we actually look for the liberal person to do, of the freely autonomous moral agent engaging in the world. And without the belief to do that, then we will open ourselves up to more and more intrusions into our private life. Thank you.